Welcome to Influential Visions. My name is Tyler Cohen Wood. Here, we interview futuristic leaders to share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring that you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. And here's your host today, Nat Schooler.
Well, today we've got a very, very interesting conversation just about to kick off. And Rand Fishkin is the was the founder of Moz. If you're in SEO, you know what Moz is. And now he's running Spark Toro, which is an audience intelligence platform. And we're here to talk about, well, I think first of all, we talk about Google as a monopoly. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Yeah, thrilled to be here, Nat. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So, it's a particularly timely episode, this one, because, we all know what's been happening with freedom of speech and things like this, right? But I think it's a very connected topic to Google being a monopoly, because, they host a lot of people's applications, right? So if someone finds out that an application, like Parler, for example, is hosted within Google or Amazon or wherever, then the platform providers almost police it themselves, right? And they can kill a business, right, overnight. So what's your view about, firstly, about Google as a monopoly?
Yeah. So I think this is a really interesting topic because I would guess that my personal views represent some from one side of the political spectrum and some from another side of the political spectrum. So I am generally in the boat that believes that Google's monopoly power is a bad thing, right? Facebook's monopoly, largely monopoly power in the social media universe is a bad thing. Amazon's monopsony, they're not quite a monopoly power in e-commerce is not a good thing. And I'm deeply frustrated that those three companies own, more than two-thirds of all online advertising. I think that's also a bad thing. And the reason I think that's bad is because monopolies, near monopolies, and duopolies tend to stifle innovation, right? So, folks like you and I, many of the folks who probably listen to your podcast, right, they are trying to innovate. They're trying to build new and exciting and interesting companies and platforms and businesses and nonprofits and charities and all sorts of things. And they are constrained by an ecosystem where one or a few companies dominate, right? In my old world, right? So my old company, Moz, made SEO software. And, well, they still do. But in the SEO world, if Google banned your website, you were essentially invisible on the internet. And Google bans thousands of websites for all sorts of reasons. And they've made plenty of mistakes over the years. I had clients back when I was doing consulting in SEO who got banned from Google, blocked from Google for doing nothing wrong, right? They were a real estate investment property website. And Google thought that some of the links that they got were manipulative. So they did, so they blocked their website, like that kind of stuff. And it sucks that Google has so much monopoly power. Yes, Bing and DuckDuckGo exist. But they combine for less than 6% of market share around the world. So that's my sort of, I think monopoly power is a bad thing. I think that these companies have too much power. And I think there's a lot of folks in the United States, at least. Nat, I know you're, it sounds like you're British, but you're in Croatia, right?
I'm actually half American. My dad grew up in Long Island. My grandfather had like a factory making partition walling back in like the 1950s. He basically moved to America back in the day and started by putting himself through school, worked in a butcher's shop, put himself through MIT, and became an engineer. And then my dad did the same thing. So, my dad's completely against monopolies as well. He's always against them. And, we used to run a winery right back in the day, like 12 years ago, that kind of finished up because of, various reasons. But But we used to run a winery, and actually within the bottle industry, there is a monopoly. And that was something that I wanted to ask you about, right? Do you think that like the market or for advertising is similar to that in terms of like, you know, you have maybe two or three locations where you can get bottles from, right? And you have certain sizes and you have certain thickness of, so there's a quality issue here, right? And then there's minimum deliveries, but the price that they charge is fixed, right? It's fixed, yeah? So do you think that like Google and Facebook and everyone else is like fixing the price based upon what people will pay or based upon what they, you know, they can get away with? Like, how do you think that works?
I mean, this is a big part of the challenge. And what's interesting is that Google and Facebook both are very smart monopoly players. So they recognize that United States law is very centered around consumer pricing, right? Essentially that, you know, the modern interpretation since the early 1980s and Reagan's presidency, since the 1980s, it has been the case that most legal decisions around monopoly power have been around the price setting power and the problem of prices to consumers. And so Google and Facebook have gotten away with a lot of their monopoly abuses by basically being able to say to antitrust investigators or potential lawsuits that, hey, the thing that we do does not harm consumer prices, right? Nat and Rand don't pay any extra for their groceries or for the jacket they buy on Pendleton or for, you know, the mug that they order from Etsy because we're a monopoly in search or social, right? And that argument has been pretty compelling up until now. I think there's now some suggestions from a number of places that it could be the case that digital monopoly analysis is evolving and maybe the, you know, governments will get smarter about this kind of stuff. Certainly the EU has been much more, you know, has a much more broad, expansive view of what monopoly power is. But for an average, right, for an average business owner, I think that the real challenge here and the core of the problem that we might be discussing from their perspective is not, you know, what's the United States Senate going to do about, you know, antitrust or what's the Department of Justice can do. It is much more about what does that mean for me as a business owner? What am I allowed to do, enabled to do? What am I restricted from doing? What's more expensive than it should be? And where should I be thinking more creatively in order to get a lower cost of customer acquisition, in order to get more branding, in order to get ownership of my data and control of my website. I think those are all really interesting topics to discuss as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I use Google. I love Google, to be honest. My brother works for Google. Yeah. My brother-in-law works for Google. Yeah. Like he manages all of the global data centers for Google. Right. So this isn't like an attack Google kind of thing. Right. But this is just raising the issue that we have is that the big tech companies can decide. Right. So they can remove applications and then they can just, you know, basically. So let's look at what happened with the president's situation. Sure. Let's look at that. Right. I don't want to get into politics because like, I don't, you know, it's not what this show is about. Right? I don't get into that. However, I think looking at the big picture, yeah. And looking at the strategy, which was obviously behind what happened. Yeah. I mean, you know, they've launched their own application, which will basically be freedom of speech, right? And what worries me is the lack of information that will come out from that, and actually the lack of monitoring that is probably going to be available within that application. So actually we're in a worse place than we probably were before he was banned from these platforms, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of the way that the people who clearly are activists are acting, right?
I guess I would fundamentally disagree with that assessment, but it depends on what your primary interest is, right? So, you know, I think there are people for whom the unfettered access to speech of all kinds, regardless of consequences, is the most important thing, right? They believe that consequences be damned if you make it more difficult for people to access any kind of information or opinion or organization, that is on the whole bad. And I would fundamentally disagree. You know, I think that, for example, Germany has been an extraordinarily successful country coming out of World War II because they intentionally said the freedom of speech does not apply to discrimination and Nazism, and you cannot promote those ideologies inside the country. And if you promote them outside the country, they are not permitted inside the country, mm-hmm. right? And so you cannot fly the swastika, and you cannot celebrate concentration camps, and you cannot organize people against Jews and gay yep. people and trans folks and, you know, Black people and all these kinds of things, right? And I think that is a very, very, in my opinion, a very wise policy move. However, mm-hmm. that's not the case in the United States. It is absolutely 100% legal for, and a bunch of people do this, right? For groups to get together and, you know, talk about how evil the Jews are and fly the swastika flag and all those kinds of things. And you see a lot of that in the United States, right? And in my opinion, that has been a net negative. However, the US does have a couple of, you know, places where it draws the line. So for example, you and I are not permitted, even in the United States, right? A citizen, a group is not permitted to incite behavior that will lead to violence, right? You can't say, oh, there's whatever, that person, especially, for example, an elected official. You can't say, oh, there's that elected official. Someone should go build a gallows on the Capitol steps, and then a bunch of people should charge in and pull out our elected officials and hang them in the gallows, right? That is not protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution, which is where the United States gets freedom of speech. So we do have some lines, they're just not drawn nearly as protective a way as a country like Germany.
Yeah.
Most countries, right, the Netherlands, France, I know that Czechia, am I pronouncing that right?
Czechoslovakia.
The Czech Republic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Czechoslovakia, yeah.
Yeah. What was previously the Czech portion of Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the United Kingdom, Canada, like most of those countries are more towards Germany's system than they are towards mm-hmm. the United States's. But, you know, it's along a spectrum, right? And what's interesting about what's happened with the president specifically is that the freedom of speech in the United States says, if you and I start a website, mm-hmm. right? We open up our own website. We are allowed to decide who we want to allow to comment on that website, who we want to allow to, you know, post in our blog, who we want to allow, what opinions we want to have. And that's an awesome thing. I think that's one of the best parts of freedom of speech is that we, the business owners, the people who built the site, we get to decide.
Yeah.
And that's what's happened this week. Right. What's mm-hmm. happened this week is that Twitter said, well, yeah, you violated our terms of service like 500 times before, but this time we've decided that you've gone too far and we're going to kick you off.
Right.
Right. And that is permitted because Twitter has freedom of speech, just like you and I would, just like any website owner who's listening to this podcast has on their own platform. You don't have to host opinions or post content or allow people to access whatever, your bar, your hardware store, right? Your yeah. winery, if you don't want to.
Exactly.
I think that's great.
Yeah, so do I. It's a very controversial issue, this one. I've been pondering it, and I've been really thinking about it. And I just posted it in one group, right? And I posted it on my Facebook, yeah, as well. And then I put it in this group, and so many people complained about the post. It was just like, all it was, what do you think about censorship or something? I can't remember the whole post. It was very short, yeah? And it just said, you know, what's your view on this, right? And like people were going crazy. And one guy, he said it's not relevant, right? But censorship is absolutely relevant. It's totally relevant to society, to business, to life. It's relevant to everything, yeah, because there are consequences. So, for example, if your Twitter account is banned, your Facebook is banned, your Instagram's banned, yeah, then what happens is all of those real core followers of yours, yeah, will go to your website and then they will get information from your website. And actually, it could become an even worse problem than it was before, depending upon your intentions, yeah? And I'm not going to comment on anyone's intentions because, like I say, this isn't a political thing. This is an example in my mind. That was kind of how I was thinking.
Yeah, so I think that your description there is a possible scenario, right? It is possible for someone, you know, once a community is banned or blocked, you know, for example, a lot of white supremacist content has been blocked and banned in the United States and in other countries over the last, you know, decade or so. And what researchers find is not what you described, right? The scenario that you described doesn't happen.
Okay.
99.98% of the people who would have been exposed to the information, whatever, in their Facebook feed or their Twitter feed or on Reddit or on YouTube or wherever, right? In Instagram,
yeah.
They do not instead intentionally go search out, like, let me go search for a bunch of, you know, Nazi content, white supremacist content. They don't, right? That's not how it works. However, okay. they can get exposed to that and have their minds sort of, you know, drawn down that rabbit hole if it is on the platforms where they already pay attention.
One of the
challenging things that we're dealing with today with social media, right, which all of your, you know, listeners, I'm sure know, right, is that social media platforms build algorithms to optimize for engagement. Right. Here's a machine learning system. It takes all these inputs in, it analyzes all the inputs, and it tries to show people the content that will be most engaging to them, that will get them to come back again and again, get them to comment more, get them to post more, get them to, you know, visit the app again and again so that they can sell ads, right? So they can sell more ads because they get more views. Makes total sense. Unfortunately, the incentives are very perverse, right? Because it turns out that one of the things for a good portion of humanity, 20, 30% of us, maybe even more, the most engaging content we can find is stuff that triggers our anger, specifically around political, social, and discrimination issues. Like, people like putting people into groups. It's just sort of how we are, right? It's why, you know, whatever it is, I don't know if you've ever taken one of those like online personality quizzes and like, oh, you're a TQWC or whatever the acronyms are, right? But those things are very compelling to a lot of people. They drive a ton of engagement. And the social platforms, it's not even the people behind the social platforms. It's not like Jack and his engineers at Twitter, you know, figure this out. It's just that the machine learning system is optimizing for engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that predicts engagement is not when you and I post adorable photos of our nieces and nephews.
Mm-hmm.
It's when we post something like, what do you think about censorship?
Right, right.
Is it okay to ban Nazis, right? And then the engagement goes crazy.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because
that's a good one. Is it okay to ban Nazis? That's a good one. I like that one, personally.
I mean,
but, you know.
So this is, right? So, like, I'm Jewish. I all my great-grandparents, except for, you know, the couple who trickled down, they didn't make it, right? And so I tend to think that genocide is a good thing to keep out of the hearts and minds of people around you. I think that it's wonderful that there are people who build websites and platforms who use their freedom of speech to kick those kinds of communities out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great. And I think it's great that there's whole countries like Germany that say, you know, we've seen this before, didn't go so well. We're not going to do that again.
Yeah.
I think that's generally a great idea. From my perspective, but there are people who feel the opposite, right?
I went to Auschwitz, right? And I'd never been before, but I was kind of in Poland, and I was like on my way to Croatia. I spoke to Eric, my buddy, and I said, Eric, I'm on my way to Croatia. He said, you've got to go to Auschwitz before you leave Poland. Like, what are you doing? So I went there, right? And I've been to the killing fields in Cambodia before. And so I was kind of prepared. Yeah, I think. You know, I saw whatever the 40,000 pairs of shoes that were in there. And I kind of got out. I got out the other side. And I went and I saw some sort of an art exhibition from the people who'd actually escaped and got away. And then I was emotional, man. Like it was deep, yeah, because it was like some of the quotes just blew me to pieces. And if anyone wants to check out on my Instagram, I've got a few still probably left there, maybe one or two. And or there might be a blog somewhere on my website, but it was emotional, yeah. And you know, these things really worry me, yeah. They really worry me, but that's a big conversation. We could kind of talk for ages about that. That's a conversation maybe for another time, right? But so do you think that they should ban people or they shouldn't? Like, what's your personal view?
I mean, if it were me running it, I would have banned it a long time ago. And then right. I don't think it would be much of an issue.
Right. Like, same here.
If the first time you launch Twitter, you basically say, here's stuff we allow, here's stuff we don't allow. And then you consistently apply your rules and guidelines. There's no news when you block and ban white supremacists, right? And there wouldn't have been an issue. In which case they probably would have blocked and banned Donald Trump in whatever, 2009, 2010, right? They would have said like, what? No, you can't say that stuff. You're out. We block people for that all the time. And interestingly enough, right, Twitter has banned millions of accounts, tens of millions of accounts for all sorts of stuff, right? For whatever, for spamming a link, like buy my affiliate product, for promoting terrorism, right? So if you say things like, hey, we should do 9/11 again, Twitter is going to block you, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that is not remarkably dissimilar to saying, hey, we should storm the Capitol again and string up all of our legislators, right? Those are very similar things. They tend to come from different people, right? One tends to come from Middle Eastern folks, historically, and one tends to come from white folks historically. And Twitter has treated those very differently. And that's a big problem, right? Yeah. Like that's clear discrimination. Like, oh, if you're brown or black and you say, hey, let's kill these people, we're going to block you immediately. But if you're white and you do it, you're going to be one of the most popular people on our website.
You make very good points there about the machine learning biased algorithms. Yeah. Like that's a whole topic on its own. Yeah. Like it's a really fundamental. Yeah. I think we've kind of kicked that around enough. Yeah. And
yeah. So I think, one of the interesting things is how that plays into how advertising and marketing work on these platforms as well, right? Mm-hmm. Because to my mind, that transition feels very different, but in fact is really, really similar. So what happens in reality is that a lot of folks, this is particularly true on YouTube and Instagram. I'm sure you've seen this, Nat, where people essentially build all of their community, their followers, their engagement, their content, they build it on those platforms, on those channels.
Mm-hmm.
And look, for the vast majority of them, they're not at risk of getting kicked off of, YouTube and Instagram because of, white supremacist or terrorist inciting content, but they are at risk of losing all of that because the algorithm changes.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, they are at risk of changing those because rules around, what's promotable and not is change, right? So, Instagram could make a change tomorrow because of a big scandal and say, we're sorry, no more pictures of people in their underwear.
Yeah,
and
true.
A lot of influencers are going to lose their entire platform, right? They will lose every follower they've got. They'll lose all their content. They're done.
Yeah, completely. You're completely right. So in terms of like social and, delivering traffic, right? Do you think that it is not delivering the traffic promise, or do you think it is? What? I mean, because there's always this conversation about organic reach, like people who don't spend money on paid ads, like, oh, my organic reach dropped. It's like, well, yeah, it's a business. Yeah. Like, that's what it is. Yeah.
So this is why, you know, I think as a marketer, as an entrepreneur, as someone who is attempting to build a platform, and you should leverage these channels as marketing channels. You should not use them as content hosting or community hosting platforms, right? So essentially, when I think about what is Twitter to me, what's Instagram to me, what's YouTube to me, what's Reddit to me, what's Facebook to me, all of those are channels where I do some marketing and promote my website and email list.
Yep.
And when and all that traffic, as much as possible, is designed to drive back, to funnel back to these owned channels, because I cannot control what Facebook will do with my account. Facebook could easily decide tomorrow, hey, you know what, this Rand guy, he's been rabble rousing about, you know, whatever it is, you know, left-wing causes. We don't like that. We're blocking him. Or yeah. the machine learning algorithm could easily identify, like, oh, you know what, Rand's content is no longer that engaging to his audience, so we're going to like show him at the bottom of the feed, and
yeah,
you know, there goes my whole, you know, whatever, 400,000 followers. So my goal is never build up more followers on these platforms. It's merely use these platforms to say things that are likely to play to the machine learning algorithm's strength and to my audience's interest on those platforms, and drive them back to my content on my website and to my email list.
Totally.
That's what I would urge everyone to do, right? That's how I think smart marketers should be operating. You play the social platforms game so that you can extract traffic from them. And one of the smartest ways to do this is to sort of recognize that what they care about are engagement streaks, right? So Nat, you know, if you go to your Instagram and you post, for example, you know, here's photos from my trip to Poland, and those pictures are very, very engaging, right? They get lots of people to pay attention to them. If you get two or three or four of those in a row that are highly engaging posts mm-hmm. on Instagram, mm-hmm. the next time you post, even if it's just like, whatever, here's a picture of my beard. It doesn't matter, right? Like,
what are you saying Instagram, about my beard, man?
I see that we have very similar facial hair patterns. So
we do.
I think you're about 18 months ahead of me. But otherwise,
what are you talking about? It's 3 days, man.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So, if you post those four pictures, they're very engaging. That fifth picture that you post, mm-hmm. Instagram will look back at the previous streak and say, when Nat posts, it's very engaging. So let's show his next post to a lot of people.
Got it. Right? I'm getting and that. So, yeah. I'm getting that on Twitter at the moment. And also, yeah, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, because basically it depends on the type of content, right? Because each platform's different, yeah? But like, I'm getting that on Twitter because I posted an amazing picture the other day. And like, people are just so into it. They were like, wow, nice picture, like loads of favorites. And, you know, so yeah, that's very interesting because I've been thinking about that very thing and wondering, like, you know, but so basically if your content's lame, yeah, like nothing's going to happen anyway. I mean, we know that, right? Like, we know that anyway.
Well, so I think this is the interesting thing. I would not necessarily say that that there is always such a thing as bad content and good content,
okay,
or even that good content does better than bad content.
Okay.
I think it's just about what do the algorithms and your audience prefer at that time.
Got you.
I have seen, I mean, Twitter is a great place to see some really mediocre garbage type of content really, really well because it's sort of timely and maybe a little bit humorous, or it's whatever, insightful, or it just came from a celebrity or whatever it is, right? So it does not necessarily matter if the content is all that great. It just matters that it matches the engagement algorithms, machine learning signals well. And so, but you play that streak game and then you can take advantage of it. And so what I advise a lot of folks to do when they're trying to drive that traffic back to their site is post high engagement, non-promotional content, which tends to do the best, right? It's not come drink my wine or, you know, come buy my software or whatever.
Your microphone.
Am I back?
Don't worry. It's all cool.
Okay. All good.
Yeah.
Right. Like a post about that non-promotional stuff two or three or four times, build up your ramp. Right.
Yeah.
And then have your, you know, link to your website, semi-promotional thing, whatever, promote your blog post. And that drives folks to your website and then to your email list. And now you've captured value from this chain.
Got it. Yeah. What I'm also trying to do is, like, certainly with the series of interviews, of actually keeping really focused on like a topic. So like do 10 or 20 interviews around that topic. And then basically just have, you know, on all the platforms you can be on, all pointing back to your website with a link. You know, the amount of links you build from having a podcast is insane. Yeah. It's crazy, right? Like thousands of links when you have a look. It's a shame I haven't just had one podcast for the last 5 years, because that would, like, if I had 300 or 400 episodes on one site, it would just be sick, right?
It builds up that flywheel, right? It sort of scales with decreasing friction, and you get that marketing engine going.
Yeah.
That is really powerful.
Yeah. But it takes time. I mean, you got to do the transcriptions, and then you got to, you know, like, there's so much work involved. I don't think people realize, like, and that's the problem, is people think SEO doesn't work. Yeah. Like, they're like, oh, SEO doesn't work. It's like, well, yeah, but have you actually done it and waited for like 2 years? Yeah. And have you used social media to actually help with your SEO? And that's something I just wanted to kind of touch with you a little bit.
Yeah. So I think two things are true that should be relatively comforting to folks who are using social media and thinking about their organic search traffic. And those are, first off, Google themselves are getting more sophisticated about recognizing what I'd say are non-direct link signals. So, for example, lots of people on Twitter and Facebook and Reddit and in YouTube comments and all these other social platforms are discussing a particular topic and a company or website or brand that's associated with it. Google will start to interpret and recognize that when someone performs searches around those topics, they should rank that associated brand, website, link, whatever it is, even if there's no links. Okay. Right. Google is very sophisticated. They analyze all this content. They have a bunch of topic modeling and topic extraction around this stuff. And so you can see this happening regularly. It's one of the reasons why when you search Google for a topic that's trending on social media, you will often find the original source or content about the original source. Right. They do a good job of this.
Right.
That's really good news for a brand that wants to do social media marketing, because if you can build up those associations between your brand and a topic on social, you'll get the link credit. And then the second one that's also very true is, as you grow your influence on social with these audiences, they are likely to link to you when they talk about you, reference you, especially if you are sort of news and coverage worthy,
mm-hmm.
right? So podcasts are a great example of this, where a host like yourself might say, oh man, you know, whatever. Nandini Jami is talking about really interesting things around, social media platforms and advertising and online advertising abuse. Let me see if I can get her as a guest, right? Or, and 10 other podcast hosts do that. And then you all, right, have her as a guest, and now she's getting all these links to her, back to her website, et cetera, et cetera. That's a great thing, right? That's like... that's a lot of momentum that you can build simply by being active in the right communities and on the right topics in social. I think the challenge for a lot of brands, frankly, is that they're scared. They're scared to engage on subjects of interest, because subjects of high interest are often those that have high controversy too.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, did you see the Yorkshire Tea? Yorkshire Tea did a tweet. I think it was about the Black Lives Matter. And I see you flying that flag on your screen here. So, behind your on your desk.
Are they a British brand?
But Yorkshire Tea, they basically, one of their customers said something like, so what happened was, this was it. Yorkshire Tea did not respond to Black Lives Matter. Yeah. So then someone sent them a tweet saying, look, Yorkshire Tea don't support Black Lives Matter, right? And then literally Yorkshire Tea thought about it for a little while. And then their social media team turned around and said, well, actually, we do support Black Lives Matter. We were doing some research to analyze the topic to decide on what our response and our stance was. And we don't want you as a customer, I think they said to this person, which I thought was fantastic. Yeah? Really was fantastic for a brand to do that. And it created masses and masses of clicks for their tea. I even bought a box of their tea.
Seriously? I love it. Amazing. Yeah, I see the BBC covered this, which again, right? You know, you talk about it, I do a search for it. There's 50, you know, news articles about this. They're all linking to not just Yorkshire Tea's website, but their Twitter account and, you know, data about their sales going up. Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah. It's big. And so also would you think, like, how do you tie in the hashtags together with SEO and social? Like, have you got any sort of tips for the audience on that one before we wrap up?
Yeah. So let's see. I think that, playing into the hashtag game has some potential, but it's not always as high as we might think it is, right? I do worry a little bit that there's this presumption that hashtags will make everything more discoverable. That is, I would say it's more true on Instagram than almost any other platform. So okay. Instagram is the one place where I'd say, like, yeah, you should do your research. You should figure out the hashtags that your audience is going to use, and you should probably apply some of those to your posts. And it doesn't really interfere with your content all that much. Anyway, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, it is possible to add value with hashtags, but generally lower. The recommendations I have kind of change literally month to month, right? So LinkedIn 6 months ago, or maybe it was a little more than that, maybe it was more like a year ago, LinkedIn was a great place to use two or three hashtags embedded in the content of your post. Now it's sort of, you know, everyone spammed it. It's kind of fallen off a cliff a little bit. Maybe there's still a little bit of value in that, but it's definitely not like it was a year ago. Twitter is kind of the same story, where Twitter is doing more and more to analyze topics. And so hashtags don't matter as much. You see that the popular topics and the explore tab are much more, much less hashtag centric than they were, say, two or three years ago.
Right. It's more of a trending sort of topic thing instead, right? So then you can basically go in, you have a look at the trending topic, and then you create something around that trending topic. I mean, that's what I've been doing. But all these things, they all change, right? Like what you're telling people now, thankfully, isn't too fixed and rigid, right? It's basically, the advice is just to keep an eye on what's going on and keep testing all the time with everything, right? I mean, that's what I've been
doing. Or you can follow people who are testing and publishing. Right. So there's there's a good number of marketers on these platforms who are running these experiments and analyzing things all the time. And they're giving good advice. And, you know, I follow a number of those folks. I try to do some of that myself. But that can be really helpful, because it can save just an inordinate amount of time running your own stuff to say, oh, yeah, look at that. You know, people are talking about this LinkedIn strategy working for them. Let me see if that's going to work for me. You know, now you know what to test instead of you're always trying random things or trying to keep up with it.
Yeah, I'm trying to there's a lot of talk about all these new platforms. And for me, I think it's a question of, like, how many hours in the day do you have, right? Like, how big is your team? Can you find some time to actually spend 3 hours a day? Like, it's impossible for me to do that. If I want to exercise, how am I going to do that? I have to take time from my exercise regime.
I promise you, whatever exercise regime you're doing, far more important than spending those 5 minutes on TikTok. I can assure you. Unless That's you can exactly combine right. the two. You know?
What's that?
Unless you combine the two, you know, do your exercise routine on TikTok.
And I've thought about that. I need to start teaching my girlfriend Tai Chi and try and convince her that we should learn and we can record some for TikTok. But then she'll get addicted to TikTok and we'll waste all our time on TikTok because it's so addictive. It's crazy.
I mean, that's the whole goal, right? The goal is to create addiction. I think this is part of the big challenge with social media as an individual user versus as a business and brand, right? And it's pretty compelling as a business and brand to become addicted to these platforms so that you can, you know, learn how to use them and earn these audiences, bring them back to your site, drive value for your business. And also, you've got to recognize that that platform addiction behavior is probably pretty unhealthy for your life, and very possible that in a lot of cases, the engagement you're getting is not leading to direct business value the way you hope it is.
Yeah, very much so. And I think, you know, just to end on that, I mean, like, you need to be putting a bit of budget into paid ads, right? Because these are businesses. You're going to get 20 times, maybe even 50, 100 times the reach on a paid ad than you would. And if you want to keep the platform in business, right? Like, that's what you're going to do. It's table stakes, right?
Yeah. And this is a very challenging thing, because I think, unfortunately, a lot of businesses go the default path of, let me just put online ads. You know, I don't know how to figure out the organic side of reach and engagement. And as a result, unfortunately, they are producing low engagement content, low engagement ads, and they're paying a ton for those. And so they're going to find that, you know, most of their margin is eaten up by the social giants and Google and search and display, the advertising budget eating into that. So it's tough, man, right? Online advertising in a mature space like the internet world is now, with, you know, millions and millions of competitors, because even people who aren't your competitors are your competitors for online attention.
Yep.
And advertising space. That is a really hard thing to do. I think one of the most beautiful things that an advertiser can do is to go find communities that already reach the audience you want to go after and go advertise and market directly in them, right? Yeah. If I know that my audience of whatever marketers and product people and entrepreneurs are listening to your podcast, Nat, I shouldn't waste my time throwing a bunch of money at Google and Facebook. I should figure out, hey, could I sponsor Nat's podcast?
Well, right? I'm ready. You would talk about it when this audience thing is finished up.
But this is what I'm saying, yeah. Right? Go find those YouTube channels that are reaching them. Go find the social accounts that are already reaching that audience. Go find the websites and blogs and news channels and industry publications, the conferences and events, the webinars, the live streams. Those places are gold mines and usually untapped, because people don't know how to find them.
Very much so. And people don't understand a lot about the audience as well, you know, and that's, if you understand the audience, then you can take that ad and you can run it right in front of just the right people that are part of your community, but actually the right part of your community. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what is marketing? It's running the right messages at the right time to the right people in the right places so that they take an action that is helpful to them and profitable for you.
Exactly. Instead of the Henry Ford thing. Was it Henry Ford that said that?
Oh, I like think you mean Wanamaker, the Coke guy?
Which guy said it? It was like 50% of my advertising's working. I just don't know which.
I think that's the Wanamaker maxim.
Oh, is that guy?
Yeah.
I love that one. Well, thank you. You've been really generous with your time, and I've really enjoyed it. I think it's a good episode because it's the end of the series. And it just brings so much knowledge to people. And it's supposed to get them thinking, not to give them a lecture. It's to get them on the path of thinking, right? And I think that's been fantastic. Thank you.
Nat, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And people, if they want to find out more about Spark Toro, is it sparktoro.com, yeah?
Yeah. Anyone can create a forever free account. We have just free accounts, so you can set it up and give it a search and see if you can find your audience, learn more about them. And that is sparktoro.com. And if you have any questions, of course, I'm always available. My email is rand@sparktoro.com.
Fantastic.
Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review.